Good morning. So, how's homework one doing? I assume it's either really easy, right, or have you guys started on it yet? A little bit. Okay. So it's due a week from today. So you guys still have a full week on it. Hopefully, at the least, you guys have downloaded the code and make sure that it runs on your computer or you've run it on a computer in the lab, right? And then remember, you do have 5 bonus days. You know that if you're going to be late next Monday, you have 5. You know, no questions asked extension days. That I would spread them out. I wouldn't use them all on this assignment. But if you need to use 1 or 2, that's probably a decent strategy. And then also, I've gotten a number of presentation topics, and pretty much everyone has gotten their first or second choice, which is good. But if you haven't sent it already, please send them to me by sometime tomorrow. And I'll try to even have a schedule for your presentations for class on Wednesday, so you guys know the order of when you'll be presenting. I'm really going to base it on what I think flows with the class. So if you're doing a capstone graphics kind of thing, it might be towards the end of the semester. But if you're doing a GPU compute application, then it's probably going to be sooner. So today, I want to finish up the parallel algorithms. I want to go back over stream compaction quickly, and then we'll look at radix sort, which I think is a good kind of summary for a lot of the parallel algorithms we've done. Maybe we can discuss some similarities between the radix sort we'll discuss here and what you guys did on the first day of class. And then we'll really start focusing on the CUDA performance, right? So we've seen introduction to CUDA. How do we what are threads, what are blocks, what are shared memories, what's synchronization? We see some parallel algorithms. Now let's talk about taking those parallel algorithms and really efficiently mapping them onto the GPU, not just naively mapping them. And I'll do a talk today on CUDA performance. And then Varun will come in on Wednesday and talk about and finish up CUDA performance. And then next week, week from today, Monday, Tim Calloway from IBM Albany Research, and also adjunct faculty here, he's going to talk about GPU search. So hopefully everyone got this printout of his. This is a preprint of one of his articles coming up in GPU Gems. So this class is very much on the bleeding edge, like I told you guys. So that's not even published yet, that work. So that's going to be a really great talk. And then Varun, next Wednesday, he'll be talking about some higher-level libraries you can use on top of CUDA. And believe it or not, that's pretty much going to end our GPU computing for this semester, right? We've actually done quite a bit already when you look at it. Then we're going to start moving into the graphics and student presentations. Now, once we get towards the end of the semester, we will be looking at mobile architecture as well as the most modern video cards on the desktop. So like we're not completely done with GPU compute or GPU architecture, but it will be kind of put on the back burner for a little while. And there's also a number of student presentations that will be focused on GPU compute. So it'll be an interesting twist to see how we migrate into the graphics part of the course. And remember, I'm definitely interested in your guys' feedback here because previously, we've taught this course here, I don't know how many times, probably like 10 times or something. And we've always taught graphics first and then compute. And now we're teaching compute first and graphics. So I'll be interested to hear both from graphics students here and non-graphics students, how it went this semester with respect to that timing. Okay, so I just want to go over stream compaction really fast. I drew this small array here, and I put these numbers in binary, right? So you have 0, 3, 2, 1. And I want to compact this array such that I only have entries in this array where the least significant bit, which is the bit on the right-hand side, is 0. Okay, so before we even do the algorithm, tell me what is my desired output. Zero, zero, one, zero. Right? Everyone's comfortable with that? Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to build another array that's the same size that either has 0 or 1 for if it meets our criteria or not. So I would say there's a 0 here, so it does meet our criteria. What about this guy? Does it meet our criteria? No. Right. 1, 0, does that meet our criteria? Yes. 0, 1? No. Okay, now we do exclusive scan here. So there's a 0 here. 0 plus 1 is 1. 1 plus 0, 1. 1 plus 1, 2. Right, now we scatter our writes, but we only write where this array is 1. So here we have a 1, so we write 0, 0 and address 0. 0, do nothing. 1, we write 1, 0 and to address 1. 0, do nothing. Right, and even though I'm doing this sequentially, that's all done in parallel, right? Because there's no write conflicts here, because every address is unique when it's masked out by this middle array. So do you guys have any questions on string compaction? There's a question on your homework that has you walk through it, which hopefully will be crystal clear at that point, if it's not already. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about sorting. So there's a million different sorting algorithms, certainly on the CPU. One that I want to talk about, because it can map pretty well to the GPU, is radix sort. Right? And radix sort is useful if your key space, the things that you're sorting by, can be described with the least number of bits, with a small number of bits. So if you only have numbers that are like, you know, 0 to 7, you only need 3 bits to describe those, and radix sort is going to be really quick. Even for integers that are 32 bits, radix sort will be really fast. It'll basically be 32 passes. We're going to pass over each bit. So what we do is, this algorithm will go, we'll start at the least significant bit, and we'll move over to the most significant bit. And we're just going to partition based on a bit value. We're going to put all the zeros a particular bit before all the ones a particular bit. And once we pass over every bit, the array is sorted. I do not have a proof for you. That will be in the analysis of algorithms class. They'd be more than happy to prove this. But this, you guys can take me on faith. I promise it works. Everyone is comfortable, right, when I show the binary numbers up here, right? Like, no one needs a refresher on, like, what number is that right there? 0, 1, 0. Everyone said 2, right? Okay, good. And I'm going to be showing numbers in binary for most of this radix sort here, because I think it will make things simpler. Okay, so here's some example input, right? I have 8 entries here, and they're unsorted, right? The first one is 4, and then 7, and so on. So they're definitely not sorted. So let's go through and partition these and see that we have a sorted result at the end. So first, I'm going to look at the least significant bit, right? And the least significant bit is on the right-hand side. Right? You see, I bolded it here. And all the ones that have a least significant bit of 0, I'm going to put before all the ones that have a least significant bit of 1. Okay, and it just so happens that this falls into half of them have 0, half of them have 1. That's certainly not guaranteed to be the case. But that's just an example. Now, in the next pass, we're going to move and we're going to look at the middle bit. And we're going to partition again. And then we're going to go to the most significant bit, the leftmost bit, partition based on that. And now they're sorted. We're done. So the bit, you know, key size was 3 bits, 3 passes. We're done. All right, and let's look at these. Let's look at them in decimal here. So the original output or input was 472, etc. Now you got sorted ascending here. And if you want to sort it descending, what would we do? Yep. Sort with most. Would that work? I wanted to say that you would flip the 0 and 1 partitions. Now I'm not sure. Now you have me confused. Does anyone know for sure what you want to do? Maybe. Yep.
Sort then reverse.
Sort then reverse. That will definitely work. Okay, let me think about that more before I give you guys a solid answer. But I thought that you would partition it the opposite direction. But let me run through an example first. Okay, so here's the big question, though. I need to know where is the parallelism, right? Because this, what I've shown you here, is sequential. We go through each pass that's done in sequence, and within a pass, I've been looking at each value and saying, do I partition it to the 0 side or to the 1 side? What we care about is extracting parallelism from this sort, right? So do you guys have any intuition for where do you think we can exploit parallelism here? Like on the first day of class, where did you guys exploit parallelism?
sending each side of the split to its own sort of core.
By sending each side of the split to its own core. Okay.
Like after the first pass, the right side and the left side don't actually need to. No, I'm just kidding.
So for a merge sort...
Yeah, for a merge sort, that's true.
Yes.
For a regular sort, that's not true.
It's definitely not true. Does everyone see that? So once you do your first partition, and you have the least significant bits of 0, they're on the left, most significant, or least significant bit that's 1 on the right, you can't just treat those two partitions separately. Because when you start looking at the next bit, the least significant bit, they might have to, they're not necessarily completely separate at that point. They might need to... be rewritten, repartitioned, such that they need to be interacting. What's the most obvious thing that you guys did for sorting, for parallel sorting algorithms? You guys each sorted a subset of the array, right? Did you guys had 100 cards, maybe 5 people, you broke up, each person took about 20 cards and sorted, right? So maybe with radix sort, we could take a big input and we could break it up into smaller inputs, and then partition a subset, and then merge them, right? That was probably for most people, I believe that was their main strategy for sorting, right? Was parallelize a sort and then merge it. There's 3 printouts up here. If anyone didn't get them yet, just don't be shy. Come on up and grab them. That table is too heavy for me to move. Sorry. Okay. So let me give you guys a little overview for the parallel algorithm. We're definitely going to take a big array and we're going to break it up into tiles. The reading calls them chunks, but I figured it would be better to call them tiles since we're already used to doing tiled algorithms with matrix multiply, even though these are 1D tiles. And we really want to do this because we have shared memory and it would be great if we could fit a tile in the shared memory. Right? We really will reduce the amount of time we've got to global memory. And then what we're going to do is we're going to sort each tile in parallel using radix sort. And that's a great amount of parallelism right there, right? And then we're going to wind up merging these tiles, and we're going to do a parallel merge to merge them. And I'll briefly talk about that, but my real focus is on how do we do the radix sort in parallel, right? Okay. So I talked about across tiles, each tile can be done in parallel. But what about within a tile? What do you guys think we could do? Okay, good. So each pass for the partition, that's very sequential, and we really have to do that in sequence. But what about for a particular pass where we're partitioning, hey, your bit is 0 or your bit is 1, so you're going to the left or the right. Do you think we can do that in parallel? If I told you we can do it in parallel, would you be able to give me some ideas how? The same as this example right here? So does anyone think I foreshadowed the answer to radix sort by drawing these in binary? Right? And then saying that I care about, in this pass, the least significant bit, 0, 1, 0, 1. And then I compacted all the ones that ended in 0 over here. Does anyone think that I foreshadowed radix sort with this? Definitely one person. Does anyone else believe me? Okay, so given all of this, how would we do sorting? We partitioned it to where the least significant bit is 0. But we haven't partitioned it where the least significant bit is 1. Or we haven't done it efficiently, at least. So let's take a look through. Let's walk through. What I really want to build up is a function that we're going to call split. And we're going to go through, each pass works on 1 bit, and we'll call this split function. And for this split function, I'm going to give you the array that's sorted, that's unsorted, perhaps partially partitioned at this point, but still not completely sorted. And then for the given bit that we're working on, where we'll start with 0 for the least significant bit, then 1 for the next bit, and so on to the most significant bit. We want this true-false array, which we're going to call the B array, where it's 1 if, it's 0 if the least significant bit is 0, or it's 1 if the bit is 1. And then the output here is going to be the partitioned array. It's not a fully sorted array, just for the given bit, we partitioned it so that the bits that are 0, those keys are before the ones where that particular bit is 1. Yep?
Is the order within the list, is it important? Like, for example, the first, the number with 0 first is the first one in the other list. So is that important?
Yep. Ask that question again.
So, for example, 010 is the second.
Yep.
Then those, like, the least significant bits, 0, can they, like, alter in the list? Like, can the order of the ones?
It doesn't matter in this part, but in the next part it will matter because they have already sorted in part. So in the next part that will matter. He's asking whether the sequence of the output matters or not. Like you put 100 first, what happens if you put 010 as the first element?
Right. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it will matter. So, and it's, I think it will become clear as we walk through this example. Okay. Other questions about the input and the output to this function? Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that B array. And I'm just going to knot it. So if I have a 0, I'm going to have a 1. If I have a 1, I have a 0. And everyone believes me when I tell you that this can be done in parallel and there's no right conflicts. And in fact, some of the arrays that I'm going to show here, you don't necessarily even need to actually store them when you're coding. Like you can just implicitly say not B, you know, subscript I or whatever. But it's clearer, I think, in the slides for me to show you these separate arrays. Okay. So now for all the bits where the bit, anytime that our bit is 0, now we have a 1 in the E array. What am I going to do with the E array? What did I do with the E array? Exclusive scan. Okay, so if I run exclusive scan here, we wind up with 0, 1, and 2s. Okay, so we wind up with 4 unique values there. And that's interesting because our input here has 4 bits where we have zeros. There's 1, 2, 3, and 4. And it just so happens that our B array has zeros wherever these values are unique. So here B is 0, we have a 0. Here B is 0, we get a 1. B is 0, we have a 2. B is 0, we have a 3.
So
this, actually I have that on the next slide. We have 4 unique addresses here, 0, 1, 2, 3. We have a total of 4 falses.
But there's
2 what? Ones. Right? There's two ones, but when you look at the B array, where B is false, there's only...
Okay. Like if you mask it out, then it becomes...
Exactly. So at this point, if you scatter where B is 0 and you use the F array, which stands for false, as your indices, you've already partitioned all of the ones where the bit is 0. Do you guys see that? It might be a little hard to visualize, but we're going to walk through the whole example. So to me, that's kind of the easy part. Not that the next part is hard, because it's not, but that's the easier part. Because now we need to figure out how we need to figure out addresses to scatter the ones where the bit is 1. Right, and the whole problem here with doing this in parallel is just figuring out how to do these writes without having write conflicts. Because you could imagine, right, you know, we love atomics, and we could just set it, you know, we could have, to partition this naively, we could have 2 separate arrays, one that all the bits with 0 goes into, one with all the bits that 1 goes into. And we could have an index into each one that's protected by an atomic, and we could try to write through, and we'd need some more synchronization as well. And then we could just try to blast through each one of these arrays, and we'd kill our parallelism. So we're really trying to avoid any type of synchronization like that. Okay, so I care about knowing the total number of false values. And I know someone brought this up last week. But the total number of false values here is not the highest number in the F-array, because this is not inclusive scan, because we never looked at the last value here in the E-array. So you have to add. So if that thing is 1, you have to add. So we wind up with a total of 4 falses. Are you all comfortable with that? Okay, so we have a false array, which I says has addresses that we're going to scatter the values that are false or that are 0. So I want to make a truer array or a T array where this is going to contain addresses where we're going to scatter all the values that have a 1. And we just have a simple equation here that we need to implement to figure out these values. And again, this can all be done in parallel, this step here. So any output or any address for a T is going to be the index. Right, so that's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 going across from left to right. Minus whatever's in the F array plus the total falses. So this is going to start, the smallest value we're going to get out of here is 4. We're going to wind up with 4 through 7. Okay, so let's do an example. Here, for 0, you wind up with 0 minus F subscript 0 plus 4. So we get 4. Now we also get 4 here. Does it matter? We got two addresses that are the same thing in the true array.
It doesn't matter if it's in the true array, that one is masked out because the value that's seeing is false.
So back up top here to the B array, look at this. Where we have a 0, we have a 4, and where we have a 1, we have a 4. Right, but really for the true array, we only care about masking them out where we have 1s. Okay, so as you guys can probably imagine at this point, we're going to do, when we do our scatter, we're either going to pick an address from the false array or from the true array based on that initial B array. You got it? And so on, and you can compute this all the way through. So now we scatter based on B, right? So here for 100, the B array is 0, so we take the address out of the false array. We write a 0 down the bottom. For the next input, the B array is true, so we're going to take the address from the 2 array. We get a 4. And so on, all the way through. And now we partitioned it. So here's the input. There's our final D array. Now look at the output. You'll see here our pass is just based on the least significant bit. So you'll see there's 4 zeros for the least significant bit after partitioned, and then 4 ones. So what questions do you guys have? I think radix sort. Look, I think summed area tables, right? They're a pretty simple use of scan, right? And I think that that radix sort is a good kind of end game for the parallel algorithm discussion, because it includes scan and parts of, and you know, basically string compaction to some extent. So this is a good algorithm to wrap your head around. Okay, so maybe some fairly obvious questions, I hope. But if I were to give you k bit keys, right? So say it's 3-bit keys, which was the example here. So how do we use the split function to do the sort? How many passes do we need? We need 3 passes if we have a 3-bit key, right? It's the same that we saw in the very beginning of class, where we would call split multiple times. Not 2-bit? So we still need to call split for every bit. So if we have 8 bits, we're going to have to call it 8 times, not 3 times, because we have to partition based on every single bit, not just log of the bits. Okay, so we're not going to focus on this in this course, so you won't be held responsible for it, most likely. Let me take that back. I may have some. You know, so there's interesting between... Like one thing that they say between an undergrad class and a grad class is that in an undergrad class, you're given information and you pretty much just need to be able to repeat that information. Like, so I show you guys how to do radix sort, and then in your homework, I give you numbers and I say do radix sort, which is exactly what you'll see on your next homework. But they say in a lot of grad, and that's going to be the homework coming out on Monday, not the homework that you have now. But they say in a graduate class, a lot of times, we show you something, and then we actually do something that we haven't shown you based on what you've seen so far. You know, they say that's a lot of times a big difference. And I think you'll see that a lot, like in an algorithms class. I don't do that much in this class, mainly because I feel that I want to build confidence, and I want you guys to do things that I'm pretty confident that you will succeed in. And I feel that when you have that confidence, well, yeah, you know, I was able to go home and I was able to do radix sort, or I was able to code my flocking, you know, my flocking CUDA program, then I think that you're going to be more likely to adopt using the GPU in your work after graduation. Whereas if I asked you like a bunch of research questions, I feel that you might be like, oh my God, I can't do anything with the GPU. GPU is so hard. And it's not that hard. But I will, you know, I think occasionally you'll see questions where I might try to push the limits on you. And definitely on your projects, I encourage you guys to do things that have never been done before or tried before. Okay, so anyway, merging, right? So I think a lot of you guys, when you did your sorting on the first day of class, everyone sorted individually, and then you probably had one pile in the middle, and everyone dropped onto it, right? And you guys did a five-way merge. So the way these guys are doing radix sort is they do parallel merges where you combine just pairs. So say we wind up with 10 tiles from our entire array, or say we have 8 tiles, that'll make it a little easier. You'll merge 2 and 2, you know, pairs, and then you'll have just 4 left. Then you'll merge them, and you'll have just two tiles left. Then you'll merge that. So it's kind of a hierarchical merge. And did anyone do that, by the way, the first day of class? I know people did a merge where everyone merged together at the same time, but did anyone pair up and merge and then do a second pass merging? Because I would be curious which one works better when it's not the GPU, but it's actual students doing it. You know, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'd be curious to know. Okay, so what questions do you guys have on, scan, stream compression, radix sort? Oh, good, you guys are overachievers. All right, so let's get into some of the performance stuff. And I think this is some of the coolest material, the coolest non-graphics material in the course. Granted, I am biased, very biased. And this is we've already been talking about how do you balance registers and shared memory and the various resources, and I say that's a big difference between someone who can program the GPU well and someone who programs the CPU. And you're going to see a number of things today that I think also show that gap between people programming the CPU and the GPU. We're going to look at parallel reduction. I know you guys are implementing that right for your homework. And we're going to look at some of the performance characteristics of that are perhaps non-obvious. And that's going to lead us to a topic called warp partitioning. And then we're going to look at memory coalescing, which is read patterns going to global memory. And we'll see how your intuition is for what type of read patterns you guys think are fast. And then we'll look at dynamic partitioning, which is how to rebalance registers and shared memory and all those different limits. And I'll show you guys, and I didn't know about this last year, but I just found it recently. NVIDIA has a great spreadsheet where you can put in numbers and then see how many warps you're going to wind up with on each SM. And then finally, hopefully with time permitting, we're going to look at data prefetching, which sounds, by the name, it sounds like a pretty obvious thing, but you can use it in a sort of non-obvious way and have like really good characteristics, and I think that's a technique, again, that separates the 10x from the 100x performance gains. Okay, and as I've already said a few times in this course, right, to really have really fast GPU code, it's a combination of having parallel algorithms, things that we can do in a massively parallel fashion, and knowing the architecture. But there's a great book that I love called Real-Time Rendering, and those of you doing graphics, how many people have that book that do graphics? Great. Awesome. 3 or 4. That's really good. So that is, If you only have one computer graphics book, do not buy my book, any of my books. Get real-time rendering. Okay, that is the best graphics book out there. And in their performance section, like they have like one comment. It's like, know your hardware or know your architecture. And they're absolutely right. So I think for going quickly on the GPU, you really need to understand what it's doing and what the architecture is based on. And definitely, like, you know, we're doing some wild stuff on the GPU at my work with constructive solid geometry, or ray tracing constructive solid geometry. And I have I was coding it for a while, and then one of our Astro guys kind of took it over because it's very math intensive. And he's not a graphics guy, he's an Astro guy. And he's always asking about how to optimize on the GPU, and like, because it's so non-obvious to him because of, you know, his use of the CPU. And he said, oh, well, if I had all these extra temporary variables, why did it slow down? And it's really interesting. Very cool. In fact, I'll try to demo some of that work that we're doing later in the semester. It's one of the most exciting things that I'm working on right now. Okay, so let's look at parallel reduction. Let's remind ourselves about it. Maybe look at some of the code. Well, perhaps even help you for your homework. And then let's think about some of the performance characteristics here. So remember, a reduction, right? We take an array input and we come up with one value. And here we're always just doing sum, right? So here's eight values. I pairwise sum up two of them. So here we say my stride is one. I'm adding adjacent values. Now say my stride is two. And then I bubble it up and make my stride four. So my stride went from two to the zero, two to the one, two to the two. And I found my sum in parallel. Okay, and like we said, it's kind of like a basketball tournament, you know, where you have, say you have eight teams, and then four, then you have four courts, so the teams can all play in parallel, and then you have two left. Oh, sorry, you have four teams, then you have four left, then you have two, then you have one, and so on. And we had enough basketball courts to do everything in parallel. I got that example from the book, by the way. Also, another thing I want to know, and I will have surveys and stuff, but you guys can talk to me anytime, is what you guys think of having the book this semester. Because I didn't have that book last semester, but I didn't require it, but I used it so much in the lectures that I'm like, okay. And the students said in the survey, I'm like, you know, I asked two questions. I go, if we had a book, would you get it? And I asked, would you actually read it? And they said they would. So you guys have to let me know if that's a reality or not. I definitely want to know about that. Okay, so let's talk about implementing this in CUDA. I'm not going to tell you all of it because that is for your homework. But I'm going to give you this kernel, which here we're going to have a subset of the we're going to have a subset of the reduction in shared memory. So just pretend that whatever we're going to do the reduction on, we already have in shared memory. That's all we're going to be concerned with. And we're just going to loop through a stride that, like I say, is basically two to the I. Or two to the stride here. So you get one, two, four. We're going to need to synchronize, okay? Just like we were synchronizing in the matrix multiply, because we're going to do this in place. We're going to do the reduction in the same input array. And if we have any threads that overwrite the input array before the other threads read from it, you're going to wind up in that pass. You're going to wind up with the wrong data here. Now the if statement, we're going to spend like 15 minutes talking about this if statement. Okay, so tell me what happens as stride, okay, so let's do this. Let stride equal 1, okay? That's how I always try to figure out algorithms. Like I have to put in actual numbers, or I step through the debugger, even better. But if stride is 1, this is T mod 2, okay? So at that point, only right off the get-go, only half these threads even do anything. And this is pretty naive reduction, right? Now, tell me what happens when stride becomes 2 or stride becomes 4. What do more threads do or not do?
More threads sit idle.
Exactly, right? So let stride equal 2, T mod 4. Okay, let stride equal, just let it go up, and you have less and less threads doing things. In fact, here's my example, right? So we have 8 threads, 0 through 7. Right on that first pass, half of the threads, the odd-numbered threads, they don't need to compute anything. They don't need to do any addition. Okay, now on the next pass, 2 more threads don't need to do anything. Then on the final pass, only 1 thread does something. Okay. Now remember, if you're going to do right off the get-go, you don't need 8 threads. You only need 4 threads to do this, and you could change the code to do that. Okay, so let's talk about tweak and implementation. And I'm going to do the smallest tweak that you've ever seen that that would be completely, we should get some guys who don't know anything about the GPU, we should bring them in today and ask them what they think this change does. Well, I'll ask you guys what you think the change does too, but you guys have much better intuition, I think. Okay, so let's start over. Here's my input. Now, instead of having my stride start at 1, I'm going to start it at 4, okay, which was the final stride last time. I'm going to have it at 4, I'm going to drop it down to 2, I'm going to drop it down to 1. I'm going to promise that this produces the same output as if I had to try going the other direction. So all I did was I started the stride at the biggest value, and then instead of doubling it, I divided it in half. But look what it allowed me to do. It allowed me to change my if statement. I optimized out the mod was killing us. Right, was that the performance bottleneck? I mean, to some extent, yeah, it's more expensive, but it's definitely not the concern here. So let me show you this. Okay, so we start off, we have 8 threads. First pass, 4 of them go away. Right, 4 of them don't need to do anything. Next pass, 2 of them don't need to do anything. Next pass, 1 of them doesn't need to do anything. Did I do anything useful here? Right. It's not like I don't have more threads doing work. I didn't start with less threads. Okay. So let's. I know you guys are flipping. I have like a million animations here. So now let's look at both algorithms right next to each other. First pass. Oh. Sorry. I'm not doing that part yet. Okay. So here's the code. Look at the if statements and tell me why. I'm going to tell you the one on the right is better and will result in faster code. Tell me why you guys think that. Doesn't use mod. Okay, so that will be a very small performance gain. Yes? What do you think?
It probably has something to do with all the threads being continuous.
All the threads being continuous. Okay. Can you expand on that, or can anyone expand on that? So I'm going to jump back some animations here. Don't mind me. Look at this. Here, every other thread isn't doing everything. And then we have 2 threads doing something. But they're not next to each other at all. The threads are all over the place in terms of the thread IDs. Where here, I'm nice and easily, I'm dropping off 4, drop off 2, drop off another 1. And this is, again, remember... let's just step forward here. So... what I care about is warp partitioning, which is how threads are organized into warps. Right? So remember we said 32 threads on G80, 32 threads are organized into a warp, and they all have consecutive thread IDs. Okay? And in this case, they're just one, we only care about the thread index.x. We just care about a 1D array. Now, if we know how things are partitioned, we may change our partitioning scheme to improve the performance. What we're really trying to do, branch divergence, where 2 branches go in 2 different directions, like we see in our code here, that happens within a warp, right? Like that I should make that a true-false question, like on your final or something, but branch divergence is only within a warp. It is not across warps. So if we can minimize the number of branches that diverge inside a warp, we can improve the performance because we're not going to execute both sides of the branch. And if you have a warp where all the threads do nothing, you can throw the hardware will retire that warp very quickly. So you kind of want threads, if you have a lot of threads that aren't doing anything, you want them to be in the same warp so that warp disappears quick, and then you can bring in new warps to have better occupancy there. Okay, so all this will make our code run faster, right? Because we'll have less idle threads, and we'll have less. And if both sides of our branches are doing work, we're going to have less total wasted work being done. Okay, so let me tell you guys a little bit about how these things are partitioned. It's basically the most obvious way you could partition it. And then we'll relook at those algorithms, and I'll show you why the second one I showed you is much better. Okay, so the partitions, it's just increasing thread index. So for 1D, just any given warp, say warp N, where N could be 0, 1, or 2, it starts at thread 32N, and then ends at 32N plus 1 minus 1. So for the warp 0, the first thread is thread 0, and then the last thread is 32 minus 1, is thread 31, and so on and so forth. And then remember, at least on the G80, we can have 512 threads per block, so a thread index dot X will be between 0 and that should probably be 511, don't you guys think? Yeah.
Wait, so on the G80 architecture, is it safe to say that you get an increase in performance more so if you can have... It matters less if your maximum thread ID even with a naive implementation is below 32. Is that true or false?
If your maximum thread is below 30.
Thread count is... Or what I should say is if you can keep everything in one warp without any fancy partitioning, then there's no increase over if you...
So you want to have more warps because more warps allow better scheduling in case there's a...
I'm saying, does it matter if you can keep... Oh, okay.
We will talk about things within a warp shortly, which may answer your question or a similar question that you didn't actually ask. Okay, so look, warp partitioning for 1D blocks, it's just linear with the thread index. Very, very simple. For 2D, all we do is lay out the rows. Treat it like it's row major, like the matrix multiply we did, and put one row after the other. So when Y is 0, that's 1D. Then Y is 1, that's 1D. And just line them right on up. And then in 3D, we're just going to start at Z equals 0, lay it out like this. Z equals 1, lay it out, and so on and so forth. And that is what NVIDIA tells us. That is how they partition warps and assign the thread indexes. And when you have Okay, so remember, divergent branches here, they're within a warp. How many times have we seen this slide this semester? Like 5 or 6? So if we can partition these such that we don't diverge in a warp, but diverge, say, in adjacent warps, that's great. Okay, so say you have a thread size of, you have a warp size of 32, and then you have thread number 31 in one warp and thread number 32 in a separate warp, and they diverge, doesn't matter because they're not diverging in the warp because they're same. They're executing different potentially different instructions. They're not working in lockstep. Like the instructions for threads within a warp. Okay, so warp size is 32 on G80. Now on my slides in my PowerPoint world, my warp size will become 2. But that's just to fit the PowerPoint constraints, as you'll see. But so for warp size of 32, if I have this code, do any of the warps diverge? Let me say I have 4 warps that are 1D, and it's in a 1D block. Would any threads diverge, or any warps diverge, if each one of them had this code in it? It's not a trick question. Yep.
Would it be the first warp?
The first warp, right? So warp 0 will have thread indexes 0 to 31, and therefore it's going to diverge because half the thread indexes are greater than 15, half of them are not. Now, once you're in warp 0, where your index goes from 32 to 63, this is always true, and so on. Okay, so this here, warp 0, would diverge. What about this? Again, so I have 4 warps. Will any warps have branch divergence? No? Does everyone would agree with me if I said no? Okay. Now that we know about warp partitioning, which production do you think is better? Well, that's, I keep telling you one on the right is better, so that's an unfair question. So the one on the right is better, but let me show you an example to hopefully build some intuition as to why. All right, so I'm just going to say warp size is 2, so I can fit everything on this PowerPoint slide here. But remember, warp size is 32 for most architectures. So here, we have 4 warps to start with. And the first pass, we had 4 divergent branches right off the get-go, because warps with consecutive indexes took the opposite side of that branch. But now on the right-hand side, where we use the less than, we don't have any divergent branches, because that less than was basically less than 4. So that was right at the separation of 2 warps. And then again, we have no branch divergence when we use the less than. Now, once we're within a warp, we got no choice. Like you have to have branch divergence at that point because you're within that warp. However, for the vast majority of the algorithm, you're not going to have branch divergence, which is great. Okay, and then like I said, also warps will get retired. Man, I have a lot of animations. Warps will get retired when all their threads are idle. So again, here, let's look at both algorithms. After the first pass, 2 of these warps can get retired right away. I mean, we really didn't even need to launch the kernel with them. But 2 of those warps don't do anything. Now, in our original implementation with the mod, you have just 1 thread in each warp doing stuff, so we can't retire the entire warp, right? So which means you can't bring in new warps. And then after next iteration, now we can finally retire a warp. Now we can retire another warp. And then in our naive implementation, now we're starting to retire warps. Okay. So that is all I have to say about warp partitioning. Do you guys have some intuition here? If you know how your warps are partitioned based on the consecutive thread indexes, and try to make sure that if you have a branch, that the branch is on the boundary of where your warps will be partitioned, not within a warp, right? And you'll get pretty big performance gains. I have numbers, I don't have them handy, but if I remember, I'll try to get you guys some numbers for the branch diversions for parallel reduction, and you'll see they're pretty significant. Okay, so the next performance topic I want to talk about is memory coalescing. And this is all about how our threads read from global memory and how can we read in such a pattern such that we're going to get the maximum bandwidth. So remember in the beginning of the semester, I drew out a matrix and I said, I don't care if it's row major or if it's column major, as long as you guys know which one it is, right? But I said in this class, I don't know why I did that. In this class, I'm going to say that it's organized in row major, right? So we took every row, starting with the top row, and we placed them sequentially in memory, one row after the next row. So what I care about is if we're going to read through this matrix, how should a thread access it? Should a thread go column after column, where therefore within a thread you're reading sequentially in memory? Or should a thread go row by row? So the thread isn't reading sequentially in memory, but threads next to each other based on their warp partitioning, they are they are reading things that are next to each other in memory. So which one do you guys think is faster and why? Because it's a 50-50 question. Should our threads read column after column, like I showed you here on the left-hand side, and therefore a thread is written sequentially in memory, or should it go row by row, where threads next to each other are reading the same address, but an individual thread is jumping an entire row? On the CPU, what would you guys do? In the CPU, we'd probably go column by column, and then prefetching will work really well, right? Actually, matrix multiply, although I don't want to go too much on top, but matrix multiply on the CPU, there's a lot of techniques to make it go really fast in terms of blocking it to stay in L2 and using SIMD instructions. But yeah, in general here, if we were reading this entire array, going column after column where you have sequential memory reads, it would be fantastic for the CPU. Okay, so for the GPU here, let's just look what happens if we go column after column. Okay, so I'm showing you two load iterations. So two points in time, load iteration one, load iteration two. And load iteration one, every read is basically a full row away from the other read. And then at the next time, every read is still a full row away from the other read. So these things are not near each other in memory, right? So now when you're going to global memory, they're kind of all over the place. Okay, now if we go row by row, that means threads that are next to each other, they're going to read adjacent memory. So now look at this. At the first time here, load iteration one, they're all going to read from the same row. They're all going to read adjacent memory values. So the threads are reading adjacent memory values. And then same, so on. And so on with load iteration two. Now, would you guys believe me if I told you that going here row by row, even though the threads skip an entire row, but adjacent threads read adjacent memory addresses, would you guys believe me if I told you this is a lot faster to do on the GPU? So the GPU is able, basically within a half warp, I believe, which is 16 threads, it is able to say, hey, these threads are all reading from adjacent memory addresses, and then it's able to read more efficiently from global memory than it is if these things are completely scattered. Right, so it is random access memory in that we can read randomly any parts of it, but we do get better performance if the reads are all coherent and near each other. And sometimes you'll look at algorithms where people will go, okay, this algorithm is absolutely data bound. There's no way that we're going to get past the maximum bandwidth that this GPU publishes, but they want to get as close to that bandwidth as possible. And they'll look at doing memory coalescing to help them achieve that maximum bandwidth. And of course, they'll look at shared memory, right, so that we're not going to global memory that much. So typically what you want to do is you want to read in a coalescible fashion into shared memory. I think this is on the next slide. Or it's on one of these slides. You're going to read from in a coalescible fashion into shared memory, and then you can access shared memory randomly for the most part. There's something called bank conflicts that Varun mentioned on the second day of class that Varun will also talk about on Wednesday, and then we can write back out to global memory. But really, when we're going to global memory, let's get it as quickly as we can into shared memory. Now, we will see at the end of the semester when we look at the NVIDIA Fermi architectures that as we start getting small caches, coalescing becomes less important on the most recent hardware. Let's see. Oh, I've told you guys all this stuff. I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, so that's memory coalescing in a nutshell. Have threads that are adjacent in a warp, read adjacent memory addresses, and you'll get better memory bandwidth usage. Good? Okay, so let's talk about something that we've already foreshadowed a few times in this class, but it's all the different limits that we have for running on a particular SM, and how do we balance these, and kind of what are the trade-offs here. So we said that there's limits. If we're going to run on an SM, we're on the G80, you're going to have 8 blocks, up to 768 threads, 8,000 registers, right, which is really 32K memory, because the registers are 4 bytes, and you have 16K shared memory. And we said as we go above, so the thread block and number of threads, that's a hard limit. You can't have 10 thread blocks. You just can't have it. But if you look at registers or shared memory, if we start going above those requirements, it starts reducing the number of blocks that we have, right? So if we go past our 16K shared memory limit, now it's going to have less blocks on the SM, right? So it's less ability to hide the latency going to global memory. And remember, like, it drops off per block, not per thread. Okay, so as I continue to get ahead of myself, so here's some examples where we could have 8 blocks of 96 threads, right? Or we could have 4 blocks of 192 threads. They both wind up being 768 threads. But we couldn't have 8 blocks of 132 threads. So when you're tying up your algorithm, that would not fly on the G80. Now, here's the thing. The register is a really big one to me. So say we have 256 thread blocks, right? We can have we can use 10 registers each, and we're going to get the maximum number of threads. But as soon as we go to 11 registers, we're going to wind up going past our 8K register limit, and we're going to drop all the way down to 512 threads. Okay, so we just lost one third of the number of threads that we had. We just lost all those warps. So there's really a balance here between how much work we're doing in a kernel versus how many kernels we have running at once. So, you know, I caution you when you're adding registers, you're adding a lot of shared memory pressure to watch, because you might hit a performance cliff where you lose a whole bunch of, where you lose a whole bunch of warps because you lost a block, and now you have less latency hiding ability. However, there are times where if you add more registers, you can actually increase performance. That's the million-dollar question today. Can anyone have any ideas where if you add more registers, you would improve performance, even though you potentially reduce the total number of threads that can be run on that processor? Man, did I even put the answer in here? No. Okay. Well, the answer is the next part of the lecture. But if we can add registers that then help us inject enough instructions so that we can tolerate enough independent instructions such that we actually can have a better chance of tolerating memory latency, you can improve performance. Where basically we're going to have, say, we reach a global memory. Instead of using it right away, we add a bunch of code that does something else, and then we use what we read from global memory. So that required more registers to do that. But if we inject enough independent instructions, we can wind up being better off than if we were to have more threads that had more memory read and then usage right away. And I'll show you a concrete example coming up. Remember, these are performance cliffs. Like you move from 10 to 11 registers, and bang, you might see you might go from 9 to 10, no performance difference. Then you go to 10 to 11, and suddenly you're down. You know, you're down 30% or something like that. So be careful. They say test early and test often when it comes to software. You know, when you're trying to test for correctness, for performance on your GPU stuff, I would test early. I would test performance early and often too, as you do changes. So what I want to show you guys, which I think is really awesome, and I didn't show them last spring, so I didn't know about it, is NVIDIA has what they call a CUDA occupancy calculator, and it's just a spreadsheet for an Excel spreadsheet that you can download. Here's the link right here. And how does that look? Wow, it's a little small. Okay, so the first thing it's going to ask you for is your compute capability, which is the version of CUDA. It defaults to 2.0. I put it down to 1.0 because for the G80, it's basically 1.0. So I want to use the numbers that we're familiar with. But here it just gives you a few inputs, right? It says how many threads per block do you have, and then it's asking how many registers per thread are you using, and how much shared memory per block. And I can tweak these numbers, and it'll show me the number of warps that I can have on any given SM. And it'll tell me what my percentage utilization is. So right now, occupancy of each multiprocessor, 100%, it says right here. And you'll see we're getting 24 warps. And 24 times 32 sounds like it's probably 768, I hope. Let me verify that for you. Good. So let's do something. Let's experiment. Let's say, okay, I'm adding 9 registers. Good. I add 10 registers. Good. Everyone knows the magic number, 11. Now look at that. I'm down to 67% utilization, it says right here. Then you saw that whole graph drop. Okay, so we hit a performance cliff. Go down to 10 registers. Well, maybe I'll use 2K memory per block. I only have 3 blocks. I'm fine. 4K, 4096. I'm still fine because that's 4K. I only have 3 blocks. It's only 12K. But my limit is 16K. So now let's put that up to 8192. occupancy is down to 67% again. Right. So this is totally a very useful tool for just quickly. I mean, you at this point you should have some intuition based on the limits here as to what's going to happen as you go over that performance cliff. You know, based. But this will just do the math for you. So a very cool tool. Definitely, don't be shy. Definitely use it. All right. So let's talk about when I said, okay, sometimes you can actually add registers, and even though your occupancy goes down, it actually improves performance. So let me show you an example here. Here, MD, that's some array out in global memory, and we're going to read from it, and eventually we're going to use it. Now, what I've done here is I've stuck a number of independent instructions, float F equals A times B plus C times D, that do not depend on that global memory read. These are independent instructions. So what can happen is this thread can go to global memory, and it has useful work to do right after going to global memory, and then eventually it needs to read back, read the M value from global memory. But it doesn't need to be. A lot of times we go to global memory, then we use it right away, and in that case the thread or the warp is going to wind up getting more likely to get swapped out. So here I injected some instructions. Now, if I can get enough instructions, independent instructions, I can actually improve performance here because now my threads are better at tolerating going to global memory. Let me show you a good example here. Okay. Matrix multiply, right? I said this whole class was on doing matrix multiply on the GPU. Let's recall what we did with matrix multiply. We took a tile from global memory. We read it in the shared memory. We said, hey, everyone in our block, sync up. Let's do a dot product. Let's sync again so that we don't wind up overwriting people on the next pass. And let's go on and so forth. So we read from global memory, use it, read global memory to shared memory, use it, and continue, right? So I feel that we can, if we increase the number of registers used here, that we can actually add dramatic improvements in terms of how much a given thread can tolerate going to global memory with prefetching. How do you guys think I'm going to do it? I'm already reading them in the shared memory, right? That's good. That's a good start. And now remember, we're not doing an entire dot product, right? You see that for loop up there? We only do, each iteration does a subset of the dot product. So how do you think we could use prefetching? And remember, we're gonna add more, we're gonna throw more registers at it. But how can we use prefetching so that we don't read and then read from global memory and then use it right away? Okay, so what if I said we're gonna take the first tiles, we're gonna read them into registers right away. And then I'm gonna drop them in the shared memory. Do I have animation here? Okay. So I have the first set of tiles that I need. I drop them in the shared memory. I don't use them, though. What I do is I load the next tile. And then I use the first tile that I loaded. So what I've done here is instead of us having load use, I have load use previous, then come back around, right? So this way I've made our dot product used to look like, back up here, our dot product was basically read-use right away, and you had to use the memory. But now, if I prefetch the next tile, I've essentially increased the amount of processing that can happen between when I read and when I use. And I think this is similar to a technique, someone correct me if I'm wrong, if you're a computer engineering student, I think this is similar to something called software pipelining. Is anyone familiar with software pipelining? No? Okay, just ignore I said that then, in case I'm wrong. So that's it. Now, notice that we had to throw more registers at this because we needed somewhere, or you could throw more shared memory at it, I suppose, too, because we needed somewhere to store that extra tile, right? We have two tiles now in memory. All right, so this is a little non-obvious. Like, you know, I certainly wouldn't. If I didn't read about doing this, like, I wouldn't have thought to change my code to do this. Okay. So when we did a lot today, I really thought we were going to go over on time, and we're under, right? So we talked about radix sort, right? We came, then we looked at performance, looked at warp partitioning, we looked at memory coalescing. We look at scheduling, dynamic data scheduling, and we look at data prefetching. I mean, tell me what questions do you guys have up until this point? Good. Okay. So please send me your presentation selection. Please send it to me as soon as you can. Hopefully tomorrow. It has to be tomorrow. Otherwise, I might assign you a topic, which you may or may not like. I will think it was a fantastic topic, but you may not. And again, part of my motivation for doing the student presentations, I have like 100 motivations, but one is the same motivation that I have for on the homework where I asked you guys, if you were teaching this class, what questions would you put on this homework? And I feel in both cases, a great way to learn something is to act as if you were going to teach it. They call that second person learning. And it's usually a really effective way to say, man, you're like forced to learn this if you have to teach it, you know? So the student presentations kind of play that role where you get to dig in, and then you have to learn it to the point where you're at the level where you can explain it. Then also, I feel that it's a really safe and good environment to practice presentations. Look, I was in a fraternity in undergrad, and they used to tell us, like the alumni would be like, oh, a fraternity is a really safe place to practice leadership. You know, like there's all these different roles that you could have where you could be, you know, in charge of recruitment or the president of the fraternity. And it's a great place to practice that because, you know, if you do something, if something's wrong, like it's just your fraternity or in college. You know, it's not a huge deal. So I feel the same thing here where you can come in and do your talk, and it's a real safe environment to get feedback. And I will give you detailed feedback on your talk. So I think it's a great experience from you giving a presentation point of view. And I know some students are taking 660, right, which is advanced computer graphics, where you will do a number of student presentations, which I think are great. But I know not everyone is taking that. In fact, I'm under the impression that a number of students are actually taking this because they couldn't take 660. The DMD students can correct me if I'm wrong. So I'm a huge fan of the student presentations, and I'm looking forward to you guys doing them. With that said, please work on this homework as soon as you can, because the next homework 3 will come out on Monday as soon as homework 2 is done. And that's all performance. It's really seeing what we've been talking about today, what we'll talk about on Wednesday, and making your code run really fast. I have, I'll use the word challenge. I've asked another university if they wanted to do the same assignment, and we'll compare performance. I thought it'd be really cool to do that competition. My request was met with silence. Not because they're afraid, they probably would definitely welcome it, but I assume, I don't know, they're swamped or something like that. So unfortunately we're not doing that, but I hope that we'll do that in a future semester. But maybe we'll come up with something for amongst ourselves where we'll compete and we'll have some kind of prize, which will be respect among your peers. So
bragging rights.
Yes, bragging rights, very important. Okay, so see you guys on Wednesday.